5048, which is Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And we'll begin with kind of an update by our LFO analyst, Susie Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have in front of you a memo from myself that just sort of gives you some background on the agency. This agency didn't have a phase one hearing, so we'll be doing covering materials from phase one and phase two. The memo just kind of presents some history on their revenue sources since 1995 and on their the distribution of their revenues to the general fund and local governments, as well as store operating expenses and payments to the agents and agency administration, which is a part which is the major expense of the agency, and then just a list of the budget notes. I'm not going to go through it in detail because the agency has a detailed presentation and they will cover much of that material. So with that, I'll introduce Teresa Kaiser, the director, and let her get underway.
Hello there.
Good afternoon, Chair Richardson.
We're limited in numbers but not in interest. So we'll just go ahead and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Teresa Kaiser, the Executive Director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. And the limited numbers actually have decreased my anxiety, although probably not appropriate still. Yes, we'll have a close chat. I'd like to start with an overview of the presentation I'm going to give you this afternoon. I want to talk a bit about our mission, our statutory purpose, and the historical perspective, agency goals and organization, program summaries, our benchmarks and performance measures. I'd like to share with you the priorities in House Bill 3182 reduction options for 0507. I'd like Michael O'Connor of my staff to review the agency-wide revenue, talk about our administrative limitation, and then for our merchandising program and regulatory program, I have internal directors who would like to speak. And I will then follow up with information about our very important policy option package on IT. And I brought a film to show you today. It's very short, but I think informative. The overall message about the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is that we have a very good story to tell you. We are a hardworking, effective agency that has exceeded its revenue goals consistently, even with staff reductions. But we have reached our limit without additional investment. We have an opportunity to bring in $10 million in distribution of additional revenue, which means $5.7 million additional to general fund, which is included in our governor's recommended budget, without raising the price of liquor. So this is a real revenue opportunity that I would like to stress. Let me begin with a little bit about the mission and vision and the history of the agency. The mission of today's Liquor Commission is to promote the public interest through the responsible sale and service of alcoholic beverages. The agency envisions itself as a high-performance model for state alcohol programs. We balance, how do we do that? We balance social responsibility, revenue optimization, and customer service. The balance is very critical. We want the maximum revenue with the maximum safety and customer service in the mix. Let me give you just a little bit of the history of the agency. It helps answer the question, why is the state in the business of selling alcohol? When Prohibition concluded in 1933, delegates elected by the people in each state ratified the 21st Amendment to the Constitution. Anticipating final ratification of the repeal amendment, Oregon's governor at the time, Julius Meyer, commissioned a special committee headed by Dr. William Knox to assess liquor use in Oregon and to evaluate the state's option in regulating the sale and distribution of alcohol. Based on Dr. Knox's report, which recommended the Canadian model state-controlled sale system, the Oregon legislature called a special session in December of 1933, less than a week after the end of Prohibition. At that meeting, the commission was formally established and immediately charged with the regulation of the sale, distribution, and responsible use and service of alcohol in the state. By the end of 1933, there were three state-selling liquor stores, all of them in the Portland area. A year later, the legislature passed the Liquor Control Act, from which all of our agencies' enabling statutes, ORS 471 through 474, issued. The Liquor Control Act also gave the OLCC exclusive rights in the sale of distilled spirits. Further, it granted the sole authority to license private enterprises to sell beer and wine with alcohol content of under 14%. This signaled the beginning of rapid expansion of the alcohol sales industry in the state, and by the end of 1934, there were 22 state-owned liquor stores and 117 contract stores. The alcohol industry is a very large industry that contributes to the economic well-being of the state. Whether you look at the folks who manufacture, distribute, sell product, the restaurants or bars that cater to citizens as well as tourists, it is a big business employing many. I think you'll have a chance before our hearings are over to hear from some in the industry, because how well the agency functions determines the profitability of their businesses as well. We have the authority and power to regulate and license all people who manufacture, sell, or serve alcohol. In 1952, Oregonians amended the Constitution to allow distilled spirits to be sold by the drink. It's hard to believe it wasn't that long ago that wasn't possible. Under our state law, the purpose of our Liquor Control Act is set out to be prevent abuses associated with consumption in premises, eliminate problems with unlicensed activities, promote moderation in consumption, and protect public health and safety. Within that framework, we're also entrusted to encourage the development of the Oregon industry, quite a balancing act. Oregon is considered a control state. That is defined as a state that takes ownership of the alcoholic product at some point and becomes the exclusive seller in a particular sector of the business. Several of our surrounding states are also control states, Washington, Idaho, Utah, and many across the country. In Oregon, the state purchases distilled spirits, actually through a bailment process. We receive, store, and ship the product and sell it through contracted private people, our liquor agents. Having the state own and sell distilled spirits in a method of control rather than an activity in conflict with control. There are 18 control jurisdictions in the U.S., 17 states plus Montgomery County, Maryland. The control state remains an effective mechanism for Oregon to use to balance social responsibility, revenue optimization, and customer service in alcohol regulation and distribution. I'd like to share with you now about how our goals fit in with the governor's principles. The work of the OLCC embodies the governor's principles of economic development, criminal justice, or public safety, and public health. Again, we vision ourselves as a high-performance model for state alcohol programs. Today, the distilled spirits industry in Oregon continues to grow as a growing population and tourism creates more demand for the product. In response, the number of businesses seeking liquor licenses continues too, providing economic development and job growth for the state. In the next decade, it's predicted that half of the new jobs created will be in the hospitality industry, and OLCC is very definitely a player in making those jobs happen. I'd like to call your attention to certain graphs contained in your book. On page 4, you'll find a graph of the Oregon population growth from the 1980s to 2004, population growth of over a million people. Similarly, on the following page, number 5, you see tourism spending in Oregon and its growth over the last 12 years, and the spending on food and beverage growth over the similar time period. We have been a good steward for the state in facilitating that growth responsibly. We need to do even better to assure increasing demand is met, that customers have access to the products they want, and business people can have their applications for licenses processed quickly. We need to assure that opportunities for growth are not lost. To do that, we ask the legislature to invest in technology and in staff for the OLCC. The 2003-05 legislatively approved budget reduced staffing for that biennium, most notably in the regulatory program, rather than the programs that produce most of our revenue. We have sought efficiencies, received approval for temporaries and limited durations to help with the workload, but these temporary and limited durations will end in June. Permanent staffing increases and technological improvements must buttress our streamlining efficiencies to keep pace with the demand for our products and services. On page 6 is an interesting graph that juxtaposes the licenses with the square block against our FTE, the triangles. At the same time that the demand for licenses and the number of licensed businesses has grown, our FTE has been reduced. So far, we've managed to stretch and cover it, but we are at the breaking point at this juncture. On the following page, you also see case handled and distribution FTE. The cases are that solid line, the growing line, that keeps climbing. The dashed line is the number of staff that we have. Again, it's been a fabulous growth, but we are now at the point where we cannot keep doing more with the same number or less.
What makes you think that the graph will continue at the same rate that it has for the last year and a half?
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman, I wasn't sure I heard you.
I'm wondering, there's always an assumption that what has happened in a recent past will continue on, so you have this graph, and you're saying you can't continue to handle the increasing load, and so I'm just asking whether or not you believe that the graph that's shown on page 7 will continue at the same steep rate of climb.
Chairman Richardson, all the industry material, scientific research material I'm reading indicates it will continue at the same or maybe even more steep growth. All the prognosticators, according to the industry, are there. And it's not just Oregon that is experiencing growth. It is growth that is across the nation. Some states more than others. Ours very, very strong. Revenue from liquor sales continues to grow beyond expectations. Public safety issues continue to need to be addressed. With the help of our business and other partners, we look for ways to increase our efficiencies to support the growing businesses without a proportional increase in cost to the state. Our presentations on revenue and the program will go into this in more detail. You'll see on page 8 a graph that shows the liquor sales revenue from 1980 to 2004. Since 2004, we are creating a new strategic plan with the help of our stakeholders, both internal and external, to try to predict how they see the growth of their business and to anticipate how we can meet them in order to make their businesses successful.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. As long as we're at this point and you're talking about your stakeholders, do you consider agents partners, stakeholders? How do they fit into your worldview of the agency?
Chairman Richardson, Senator Johnson, they are part of our stakeholder group. They're also agency contractors, so we have kind of dual roles, one an oversight role, but another a partnering stakeholder role as well.
In your opening remarks, you talked about how the agency has exceeded its goals and it's a high-performing agency. What role do you think that the agents play in exceeding your goals?
Chair Richardson, Senator Johnson, the agents, the individual agents, each have a role in the retail sales of our product.
I know that.
And their success is our success. Our successes are tied together.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd like to reserve the opportunity to come back and visit that dual linking of the successes, that your successes rely on the successes of the agents. And so when we get to that point in the discussion, I'd like to come back and visit that.
Please continue.
Thank you. Our last strategic plan was created in 1997 and was updated in March of 2002. At the present time, we're looking at a retail business plan created in 1999. Right now, we are working together to create a retail business plan for the next 5 years. We have to be able to predict and accommodate the growth, or we will be unprepared to take advantage of the opportunities. The plan we're developing today focuses on goals based on three high-level visions. The high-level visions are safety, revenue, and customer service, the three areas where we want to push forward. Work groups will be fleshing out strategies to attain these goals, vehicles to use to give the strategies wheels. They'll also be used in identifying and developing new measures so we can quantify our progress in meeting these goals. I'll report to you on some of the information that is still in development. After I explain our goals, programs, and priorities, I will tell you about the performance measures we have been using until now. I do want to stress that we are developing new measures along with a new strategic plan. Our hope is to gain electronic capabilities to gather and track data better in the future. Our policy option packages reflect this direction. I should point out that the industry, other state liquor control agencies, and those open states do not have benchmarks as yet. We hope to be instrumental in pushing for universal benchmarks so that we can compare with other states our performance. Our strategic plan in development has the following vision and goals. First of all, for the safety goal, we will be a model of social responsibility in liquor law administration, public safety, and community livability. We want businesses that sell alcohol beverage to improve their liquor law compliance. We want to diminish the negative impacts of alcohol in the community. We want our actions to be objective, fair, consistent, and legal. And we want to balance regulating the beverage industry with supporting the industry's growth. Our second goal is revenue. We want to optimize revenue production, balancing social responsibility with meeting customer demand. We want to improve our distilled spirits products operation for optimized liquor revenue production, optimize revenue production from non-distilled spirit source, gain more flexibility to more quickly respond to market changes, and improve our return on investment. We wish to be a model of customer service, increasing customer satisfaction with our external customers and customer satisfaction internally with our staff. Our overarching vision is to become a high-performance model for other state alcohol programs. In two ways, managing risk and achieving quality high performance. I mentioned we are going to be working with the National Alcohol Beverage Control Association to develop benchmarks for state control states to use in discussing and comparing their performance. We have initiated a Western state meeting to focus on performance measures. We think the Western states often lead, and we want to be part of creating the beginning of nationwide benchmarks by which each of us can be measured and can report to you just how efficient we are. Meanwhile, how do we know how efficient we are? I do have performance measures I want to report to you on. I think it's important for you to understand the distance that we're closing with both our business stakeholders and our policy partners. For the past year and a half, we have been meeting regularly with groups of business partners as well as groups of folks interested in the policy aspect, law enforcement, moderation groups, police chiefs, district attorneys. The two groups are helping us close the gap between how the agency performs presently and what either the industry or the moderation community needs us to do in order to be high performance. We've identified, prioritized many things we needed to fix, correct, implement in order to close this gap, and I think you'll hear later from some of our partners just how successful this iterative process has become. Let me talk to you a bit about our program priorities. Our first priority is our merchandising program. All Oregonians and tourists who buy distilled spirits buy them from contracted liquor stores or licensed businesses that get products from the stores. Whether you consume alcoholic beverages or not, all Oregons benefit from the sales profits distributed to Oregon cities, counties, and the state general fund. We're guided by the governor's principles of supporting and increasing the economic development of the state to invest in the future of Oregon by providing a supply chain for the alcohol beverage industry and the hospitality industry. Included in the governor's budget is a policy option package to increase staffing levels in the distribution center so the OLCC will be able to continue to meet consumer demands and increase amount of revenue returned to the state. With the increase in sales, of course, we need more people to move the cases. We have more cases to be moved, more everything to be done. Our second priority is a regulatory program. All Oregonians and tourists who buy alcohol by the drink are impacted by the number, location, and liquor law compliance of liquor establishments. Oregonian safety is protected by our regulatory program, assuring licensees comply with liquor laws. Our priorities here are keeping alcohol from underage drinkers and keeping visibly intoxicated persons from being served to preserve public safety. Included in the governor's budget are policy option packages to increase the number of liquor license investigators to better serve the public interest. I should point out that the added staff, if you're concerned about funding, are tied to another piece of legislation that is being referred to Ways and Means, which would establish an application fee of $400. And you will find the industry supports this. You will hear from the industry that they support this. Why do they support it? Because they want us to have the additional staff in order to process the license applications timely. They want their businesses to open promptly. The third priority is administration and support program. It's the guts, the behind the scenes that keeps the other programs working, coordination, management, reporting, and physical infrastructure. We operate in conjunction with the other two programs to assure functionality and accountability. The fourth priority is the store operating expense program that funds the operating expenses and income of contracted liquor agents. It provides resources for the 241 independent businesses that make the product available by the bottle. It helps them to pay for their rent, utility, wages for employees, and the net income for the liquor store owner. The agents generate in excess of $600 million of sales each biennium, which encourages economic activity in private businesses in the hospitality industry. Revenue remaining after paying operating costs of agents, cost of goods sold, and operating expenses of the commission are distributed to state and local governments to support programs in the public sector. Our fifth priority is capital improvement. It provides preventative maintenance and repairs to our buildings and grounds. It prepares a 10-year capital maintenance plan and uses the resources to ensure the continued viability of the physical infrastructure. Appropriate maintenance assures that the two operational programs are able to meet the governor's principles for enhancing economic development and promoting public safety. Our reduction options are available in detail in the chart under your priority tabs. Now I'd like to introduce Michael O'Connor to review with you the revenue.
Okay, thank you. Mr. O'Connor.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael O'Connor. I'm the Director of Financial Services for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm here to discuss the main sources of revenue for the commission and to describe the distribution of earnings after paying for the agency's operating costs. The commission has three main sources of income, which are sales of liquor to consumers and licensees, the collection of privileged taxes, and the collection of fees for the issuance of licenses to persons and businesses engaged in the alcoholic beverage industry. Liquor sales, after our most recent forecast revision last week, is now projected to be $645 million, based on the governor's recommended staffing levels. The governor's budget is proposing a policy option package, which will be described in the merchandising program discussion, to increase the staffing in the distribution center. This proposal will have a positive impact on revenues of more than $40 million. Liquor revenue is collected by more than 240 independent contracted liquor agents who sell OLCC-owned inventory and deposit the proceeds directly into OLCC-owned treasury accounts. Liquor revenue collections represent approximately 95% of the total sources of revenue for the commission. The second source of revenue for the commission is the collection of beer and wine taxes called privilege taxes. Privilege taxes are assessed on the production or importation of beer and wine into the state of Oregon and are forecasted to be approximately $26.7 million in the next biennium. The last primary source of revenue is from fees collected for the issuance of licenses to persons or businesses engaged in the alcoholic beverage industry. Forecasted license revenue of $6.2 million is about 1% of the total sources of revenue for the OLCC. If you'll now refer to page 4 of the revenue section, you will see a diagram that outlines the cash distribution that OLCC makes each month based on statutory requirements. The commission collects all the revenue from its different sources each month and accumulates the funds in the state treasury accounts. By law, 2 cents on every gallon of wine tax is distributed to the Oregon Wine Board each month. The remaining beer and wine tax is divided in two, with half sent to the mental health, alcohol, and drug treatment account, and the remainder is included in the commission's accounts along with the liquor and license revenue proceeds. From this pool of revenue, the commission pays the distillers and producers of the products for the cost of goods sold. The commission also pays for freight expense and the store operating expense commissions to the independent liquor agents. The commission then pays for all the operating expenses of the commission. The remaining amounts are then distributed based on statutory requirements as listed at the bottom of page 4. From the amounts distributed, the general fund receives the lion's share of 56% of the available funds, and cities and counties of Oregon receive the remainder. For the 2005-07 biennium, the commission projects the general fund to receive $136 million of the available cash, and Oregon cities and counties to receive a total of $106 million. And I'd be delighted to answer any questions that you may have.
Senator Johnson.
I don't know whether to direct this question to you because you were showing the flow, or whether or not to direct it to the director. But so let's start with the director. In your overview, you discussed how your success is intertwined with the success of the agents, and you discussed how important customer service is as one of your goals. The governor's recommended budget has no increase for your partners, the folks that you described as integral to your success. And I'm just curious what your position is on the agent's request to increase their compensation as part of this overall scheme that distributes $136 million into the general fund and $106 million to cities and counties.
Chair Richardson, Senator Johnson, I think what you see reflects no increase in the rate, but it's definitely an increase in the overall compensation paid to the agents. With every additional sale, they get a percentage of that sale, so there's a natural incremental increase as sales increase.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator.
But they're responsible for doing that. And you talked about, in your overview, looking at an opportunity to do your capital maintenance, for example, to work on your physical infrastructure. Their physical infrastructures need to be attractive in order to maximize their sales. So speak, if you would, directly to the question of not the natural pass-through from increased sales, but specifically to the agent's request for an increase in compensation.
Chair Richardson, Senator Johnson, it's certainly a legislative choice how the revenue flows. It's not my choice. The legislature sets the fixed amount, but I could tell you from an agency perspective, if you gave me a percentage, I would be quite happy.
I'm not sure I understand what that means.
In other words, we don't have, the agency doesn't have the benefit of retaining a percentage of the revenue generated to operate the program, or we would not have to come back and ask for increases. Were we able to have a fixed percentage, like some agencies do, it would not be an issue. But whether it comes down to what the agents are compensated, definitely the legislature sets that priority.
Okay, so what you're saying is that because of the increase in sales, since they're on a set percentage, they've made a lot more money than they did when the sales were less, and that if you as an agency got a percentage of sales, you'd be happy as compared to coming in and asking for set dollars. Is that what your answer was?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You were more artful in that response than I was.
Okay, now, am I correct that there was an increase in the fee that has raised it to 8.88? I mean, 2 years ago it went up by, what, 0.34%?
Mr. Chair, I believe that is correct. I believe it went from 8.54 to 8.88.
Okay. Can you tell us how our fee structure compares with the other states that also have limited control over alcohol sales?
Mr. Chair, for as many states as there are that have contracted agents that each have their own rate structure, you know, and we'd have to get back about specifics about how much they're paying for each, but the last time we did do a study, we were comparing very favorably to many of the states.
Okay, I have here a budget note from the last session, which says the commission has directed to survey the 20 control states to establish comparison of the cost of liquor in other states to the state of Oregon's costs. Results of the survey shall be reported to the emergency board in April of 04. Mm-hmm. Was that report related at all to the question I asked?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, that actually had to do with the price that we were buying the liquor from our vendors. It didn't have anything to do with the commission structure for the agents.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, along that same line, though, I think you've touched on something that's very important, and I know we're using it as a yardstick in the other committee that I serve on, the other Ways and Means Sub, and that is how we do compare with some of our sister states. And I think that would be very useful to the panel for those states that have a program that resembles ours, to know what those agents are reimbursed. If you could bring that back to the professional staff and give it to the whole committee, that would be very useful.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative Avakian.
In addition to that, if you have information regarding other elements that influence the revenue stream, such as the price per bottle or other things that I may not know about, I'd be interested in that, because I think, because we have before us a proposal to increase the amount the agents are getting, and we don't want to make that decision in a vacuum, because if there's a way to adjust the pricing in another way so that the state doesn't lose revenue and the agents are able to get more money and that the market doesn't suffer, that you continue selling at the same rate or better than you can, then maybe there's a good solution for everybody.
Mm-hmm. So we would appreciate more than just a comparison on the rate itself of commission, but also other factors, pricing factors and percent of overhead that goes to a management. If you could give us as much information as you can, maybe that's not too difficult. Hopefully there is some kind of a clearinghouse or periodical or association that might provide that. If it's too difficult, let us know.
Mr. Chair, we'll look and see what we have.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Next, I would ask Steve Farrell, the Acting Director for Merchandising, to speak in more detail about the merchandising program.
Good afternoon, Mr. Farrell. Thank you for being here with us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members.
We hope that it's not a boring or long meeting.
But Mr. Chair, respectfully, any hearing that starts with the witnesses taking out bottles of alcoholic beverage can't be a bad hearing.
It's party time.
Aren't there supposed to be like six copies for the diners?
Very good point.
We've got a protocol problem here.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much for letting me be here today. I'm Steve Farrow, Acting Director of the OLCC Merchandising Program. I'm going to talk a little bit about the merchandising program in the sense of an overview, customer service and improvements, the liquor industry in general, our contracted agents, where we expect to go and what we need to get there. In 1933, as Executive Director Kaiser already pointed out, there was a decision to be made. That decision was whether to go open or licensee or become a control state. Oregon selected the control state model. The merchandising program operates the state's distilled spirits business on behalf of the citizens of Oregon. And the purpose is to make distilled spirits reasonably available, but not to promote consumption. Yes. This program provides for purchasing, distribution, and sales of distilled spirits through our 241 contracted agents, through our 125,000 square foot distribution center, all with only 49 full-time employees. We generate over $600 million in working sales through 90 suppliers, many of them large international companies, but also through a lot of really small mom-and-pop suppliers. We meet our growing customers' demand by offering approximately 1,300 different products. The market has changed perceptibly in the last few years to the point where there is a lot of niche marketing. It has gone very upscale, appealing very much to women now, and this has really brought about a proliferation of liquor products. The suppliers retain ownership of the $25 to $30 million worth of liquor that is kept within our distribution center. That's referred to as a bailment warehouse. Essentially what happens is we do not have to pay for that liquor until we get ready on the day we ship it out. We will ship over 4 million cases, that's over 44 million bottles, at a retail price of from $1.50 per bottle to $5,000 per bottle. Sales for fiscal year 2004 were $293 million.
I got to know. $5,000 a bottle? That's mighty special bottle.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it is a very special bottle.
You should see the size of that bottle.
There's a very upscale cognac in that bottle. Most of it's over 100 years old. There are basically three that are in the upper end. One's about $1,500, another one's $1,600. This one, however, sort of breaks the bank at $5,000 per bottle, and we have had sales on it.
That's God's way of telling you got too much money. Thank you.
The program is very lean and profitable. The distilled spirits demand has really increased markedly over the last few years, and that has really put a strain on the distribution center and the commission being able to support that. Our goals are consistent with what Oregon residents said when we conducted a telephone survey. It was actually conducted by Campbell DeLong Resources in November 2000, and they said basically, we're happy with the way the system is. We're not looking for any radical changes. This sort of leads us up to our attention on customer fulfillment and service improvements. We manage the merchandising system using good business principles, allowing agents to apply their skills to run the stores. We meet stakeholder needs by keeping the system relevant in today's world and work at improving the system through modernization and technology efficiencies. Examples such as our warehouse management system that uses radio frequency. I brought this scanner here to sort of demonstrate. If you can imagine the distribution center, 125,000 square feet, on the ceiling, we have a lot of radio transmitters. Within the warehouse management system that we have, it knows all the orders for that day, it knows all the products, it knows all the locations. And essentially what will happen is the distribution worker will go to a particular location, he'll scan a barcode on that location, and then he will take the product, either the case or the bottle, actually use this laser, hit that barcode right here, and that then records the actual movement of the products. At that point then, he'll go ahead and complete that cycle. He'll ask for the next task. Then he'll go maybe to the next location and he'll pick that bottle up. He'll scan that barcode and it sends him on to the next task. One of the great things about this system is it is real time. We will know at any given time during the course of the day where we are on that particular order or any other orders. We know real time about products within the warehouse. We know locations. We know how many we have. It has really helped out considerably. That is one major thing we have done to really try and move the distribution process ahead. We need to do more. We are nationally recognized by the liquor industry as being very innovative. We work very hard at streamlining our procedures to go ahead and allow for faster review and acceptance into our distribution system of the new products that are coming out. As I mentioned before, we have moved up to around 1,300 different products that we handle. We also are getting a deluge of what I will say is marginal products. We do special orders on those products. And that is where a particular customer asks specifically for that product. We put in one specific order. That has moved in just the last 3 years alone from 2,800 per year to over 7,000. So you can see the market is becoming very diverse, and people see things on the web. They see things in advertising, and that's what they want to get. We monitor and adjust the inventories as necessary to meet customer demand. The liquor stores, which are very integral to what we do, have the business hours on Saturdays or are able to be open on Sundays and holidays. Agents also may now deliver to licensees.
Just a moment. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Out of your universe of stores, how many elect to be open on Sunday?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I don't have a current number on that. It looks like it's about over 30%, though.
Okay.
We have recently opened 9 new stores, 3 of which have been within the grocery stores within our store within a store program, part of our pilot project. Those are exclusive liquor stores within the group.
One other question about the store within the store. Do you have any tracking data on how that's working out right now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, yes, we do. It has proven very successful in terms of sales. Sales were over $1 million since we've started that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I'm curious. I keep going back to this partnership relationship, and to what degree were your partners involved in the decision to do the store within the store? What was the process to take input on that decision in terms of competitive advantage for one liquor store location over another?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we did have a representative from the agents in at the earliest meetings. There was discussion about how we should proceed forward. However, I'm not sure that it proceeded forward the way necessarily that they wanted it to, but we did have them early on in the process.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Early on, like they were around for the first third or the first two-thirds or the first meeting only? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, they were there at the first meeting and the follow-up meetings. I think there were like 3 or 4 follow-up meetings.
I'm sorry, I'm confused. So they were at all of them, or?
I did not participate in all the meetings, so I wouldn't know on some of those.
Just maybe the director knows.
Senator Johnson, we had agent involvement from the earliest discussions in the fall of 2003. I even had them present when we met with the grocery stores. I had a representative of the agents present, so it would be transparent. In both meetings with the grocery stores, they were present. We would have had an existing agent go into the grocery stores to open the pilots, but the stores refused. They said they were taking enough of a risk giving up floor space for this pilot project. They would not allow an outsider to come in and run the agency. It had been our hope that an existing agent would do that. The first 3 are open, and by the end of this first year of operation, in the aggregate, they'll have generated $5.3 million in additional revenue, which again leads to the increase. Our hope is that of the next 3 pilot sites, we will take existing agents into those stores.
Just before I go back, though, if we are generating $5.3 million, then obviously it was a success for those stores. And so now that there's no longer a risk on their floor space, I would assume that there could be further negotiations if you feel like it's better for the state to be involved. Senator Johnson.
I would be very curious to know as well the effect on the surrounding existing stores, whether as you were seeing success in the grocery store model, you were seeing a drop-off in sales in your other stores. Was that information requested or reported to you in any way?
Chairman Richardson, Senator Johnson, we carefully track that information on a monthly basis for the pilot site and all of the surrounding sites. There have been various effects on depending on which of the surrounding stores you're talking about, but we very carefully monitor it. There have been some initial decreases in sales volume depending on the proximity and attractiveness, hours of operation, and other variables. But as the months go by, the sales in the affected nearby stores begin to climb again. And we do have that data available and, in fact, have furnished it to the agents who requested it.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I think the panel might enjoy seeing it if it could be provided.
Mr. Chair, I can absolutely provide that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, as Executive Director Kaiser mentioned, we are targeting the next three store within a store to have agents actually running those stores within the stores, and we are well on our way to hopefully bringing that about. To reflect with regards to how the grocery stores are looking at this new opportunity, they have approached us, and it is very clear that they understand that it is a real bonus for them to go ahead and have a liquor store there. So it does give us greater leverage in actually dealing with them. We did have all three have passed recent OLCC compliance checks, and in January, law officials confirmed that there had been no measurable increases in alcohol-related problems or other crime in surrounding the pilot stores. We continue to look for ways to improve our customer fulfillment. It should be noted that the current retail district manager to store ratio needs to decrease from the current 50 if we are going to recognize retail success. Our contracted liquor agents and distillery industry continue to be our partners in meeting our customer expectations.
Would you please repeat what you said about 50?
Mr. Chair, yes. Currently, we have district managers that visit all of our stores, and currently we have a ratio of one district manager that has to visit 50 stores. Okay. So one per 50, so it's a little difficult to go ahead and have the kind of relationship and time that is necessary in order to go ahead and make some of the retail changes that perhaps we would like to.
Okay, but if you have existing providers running the in-store, the future in-store locations, then it's a little different than if they are completely separate and distinct, and because you still have the same management, you just have two locations. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, that would be correct. That's how it could work out. However, there is nothing saying, because it is a public process, that the store within a store that actually has an outside agent could actually be a new agent, not necessarily one of the existing ones.
That would actually go back to Senator Johnson's questions about having your existing agents be involved in that discussion. There's kind of a balance between relationships that you have and the effects on them of competition. I mean, I guess not that it's a monopolistic kind of thing, except that the fact that the state handles this to begin with is monopolistic. And so I think from the line of questions that Senator Johnson has asked, am I correct that you would like to assure that if you have a state-run store that's a short distance away from a grocery store that is considered, that state-run operator would have some input before decisions were made as to who would be the operator for the in-store, the new in-store facility?
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct. In fact, the upcoming three stores that we hope to open do have directly involved the nearest agent involved in that process. Okay. And at this point, it looks highly likely that they will actually end up with the stores.
Although, Chair Richardson, I would like to point out that in the past, as the state has opened new stores, it has been our procedure to advertise for an agent in the location where we wanted new stores. The agents surrounding that new location are individual contractors, and while it's our goal not to cite any two agencies too close to each other, you would be asking them to weigh in on a potential competitor were they to take part in that selection process. Although they may compete, an agent may be considered for a second store. It's a really fine line between arm's length bargaining and oversight and participation in these kinds of decisions.
Okay, yeah, I was not implying that they should be involved in the decision, merely that they would have the opportunity to participate. In other words, you don't just do it without even contacting them, because there's significant financial consequences to them. But I'm not saying that they would have to sign off on it.
Based on the 2005-07 governor's recommended budget, we are targeting about $57 million based on the biennial sales of $645 million for the store operating expenses. The contractor liquor agents operate all the liquor stores in the state. They are really the frontline troops out there working with the customers. The agent's commitment contributes to the livability and safety of the communities they serve. They're responsible for selling the over $600 million in sales, handling and depositing the proceeds in state accounts, and managing the inventory that they have within their stores. The OLCC pays agents monthly for their services. And of the agents' pay that they receive, they have to go ahead and take care of all the expenses associated with running that business. The store rent, insurance, telephone, electricity, water, etc., including employee salary, sick leave, vacation coverage. Then what's left over, they also have to go ahead and cover their own salaries, Social Security, state, local taxes, medical insurance, and any retirement plan that they may have. Both the liquor industry and consumer data leads us to believe that distilled products will continue to have strong growth. The state population also points to strong growth. Sales in distilled spirits have increased dramatically. In fact, from 1996 to 2004, we've been up over 500,000 cases. The liquor industry has tapped into what was previously were part of the population that used to do little consuming. In fact, the latest numbers that I saw, beer sales had fallen from 59 to 56. And it is pointing, as the executive director has mentioned, that distilled products look to come on strong. We do value the fact that we are the only game in town. To that reason, we do make sure that of those 1,300 items that they meet the customer's demand. For instance, in the scotch category alone, we have over 109 selections. In the vodka category, we have over 198 selections. Tequila's 94. This is just an example of how the market is proliferating. We continue to look for ways that will better fulfill what the customer wants. There are two policy option packages that will help us do that. One of the policy option packages deals with our IT needs for the future. Policy option package 301 will begin to go ahead and give us the opportunity to collect data, information, share, build the reports that we need so that we can better manage the system, as well as work very closely with the supply chain. One of the important things when it comes to meeting customer expectation, and I'll use the term customer fulfillment, that's when you have the product in the store when the customer wants it. And one of the things that can happen to us if we don't get data as early as we can, then the supplier perhaps ends up falling short if expectations have increased in terms of the sales of that product. So part of this technology package would also give us the ability to virtually know real-time sales, at least on a daily basis, so that we would be able to go back to our suppliers to make sure that they know if sales spike and move faster than what was expected.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Before we leave this point, do you with respect to this modernization package, what impact do you see that having on your partners, the agents?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, some agents have systems that will see virtually no impact. Other agents that do not have systems will see significant need to go ahead and improve their technology in order to communicate with us.
And I follow up, Mr. Chair. And I deduce from the way that you phrased that, if they don't upgrade their technology, they won't be able to communicate with you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, under the current scenario, we are still looking at options about how to communicate. So it's not, as I would say, a done deal on how it's going to take place. For instance, it could be web-based, but then we are also looking at a system that can go through telephone lines, and that means they don't need to get on the web. So there are still some things that need to be worked out. But by the same token, we have agents out there that use Scantron systems, which is the old 1950s IBM where you take a pencil and fill in between the lines. And there is no way to really communicate with that in any system that I'm aware of other than changing it over to a POS system that reads the bottles and tells us what we've got for sale.
Thank you.
Since you have a monopolistic system, if you have providers that can't afford the capital investment to upgrade, do you plan on making available to them financing or other means so that they could stay in business and comply without having to go out and mortgage the home?
Chairman Richardson, what we're looking at asking of the agent is daily sales data, not necessarily electronically. Even if it was hand-computed, if that could be communicated to us. As Director Farrell pointed out, we are exploring options with industry that might build our systems for us. And chief among the evaluation components would be ease of use by the existing agents. But the bottom line is we're asking for daily sales data. However they calculate it, handheld, electronic, however, as a cost of doing business with us.
Okay, well, it's a unique situation. I mean, realize I'm over human services, and so I'm over drug and alcohol and treatment and the Oregon Health Plan, and I find it somewhat of a paradox that we're congratulating for the additional sales of alcohol, which have such a negative effect on the other side of this equation. Nevertheless, this is the way that Oregon is gaining substantial amounts of revenue. But because your agency controls this whole system, and you have 241 locations that are depending on what you do for their future and their revenue, then you have a duty to help assure that you don't squash them merely because you say, this is what we're going to do, and you either line up or else we'll get somebody to take your place. Because it's not like they can just choose not to sell your product. They'll just sell Fritos instead of something else. You know, I mean, it's not, you have such power over their streams of revenue that you're in a position where you have to play multiple positions. Mm-hmm. One is to help assure that your distribution networks are cared for, just as if you were General Motors and you had different dealerships.
Yes.
And so as you make your final decisions on IT and so forth, certainly we would expect that you will keep into consideration how that's going to affect them, get input, and then try and make available ways to help solve their needs so that they can continue to do what they have been doing for you, because they're, you know, you're the umbilical cord, you control this for them. And so there has to be a balance there, and we just hope that you would be mindful of their needs as well.
We agree, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, just as a follow-up on that, we have already had a meeting with the primary POS, the point-of-sale providers that most of the agents use, to sort of bring them in to understand where we're looking to go. One of the things we will certainly be looking for is input from not only the agents, but also the providers that work closely with them, because they know the systems out there, they know what the agents are using for that.
Okay.
The entire industry is dependent on this information, not just our agency. The manufacturers, the shippers, the distributors all need to have daily sales data to be as efficient and effective as possible.
No, I understand that, and I'm not saying don't proceed. I'm just saying be mindful of what you may have to do to help others to stay on board as you make these changes, because your distributor network are dependent on what you do for their outcomes.
Yes.
And incomes.
As I've been saying, the importance of the IT technology package is really stressed in the fact that if sales begin to spike for a particular product, we will know that that is speeding up as far as purchases. We can go back and get to the supplier, have more product on the way. We will also be able to move product around the state by better understanding what the sales patterns are. Along with the need for the IT or information technology improvements, we also have pretty much reached the limit in terms of what we can handle going through the distribution center without getting additional staff. As I've already mentioned, sales have really spiked up, and it looks like they continue to be very strong. For instance, I also related the fact of going from 2,800 to over 7,000 special orders in just 3 years' time frame. That is very time-consuming, but I want to point out that the $5,000 bottles are handled through the special order process. So even though it takes a lot of time, there can be a lot of revenue coming in via that slower process.
Well, since these are special ordered, is there also a handling and service fee beyond that which they would have if they just walk in and buy off the shelf?
Mr. Chair, there is a very nominal fee attached to the special orders.
So is that something also you're looking at to assure that it is adequate?
Mr. Chair, I think what we were doing is focusing on the fact that we were making a lot of revenue off of it, and that was the primary thing that we were looking at. And we were also hoping with the technology improvements, because we are making improvements on our own web-based processes, that we will actually be able to make that more electronic, which may speed up. So rather than put additional cost on it at this point, we believe that we can compensate some of that with improvements in our technology.
I imagine shortly after Prohibition stopped that the idea was, how do we manage a new industry with a product that was outlawed throughout the country for a period of time, and now, 70 years later, this is one of the main sources of income revenue to the state of Oregon, and so the considerations are not the same. Not that there aren't still the considerations that existed then, but now they've gone far beyond that, and I would think, you know, that you will be, I'm sure you're looking at various ways that you can generate additional revenue, and not so if you have a huge increase in special orders of highly expensive products, then I would think they ought to be paying their own way, not merely in the revenue, but also on handling. Everything you buy has got handling costs on.
Duly noted, Mr. Chair. Policy Option Package 102 provides for 4 full-time additional equipment operators within the distribution center and would also provide us for 4 seasonal employees. One of the things that we certainly will look forward to is getting the seasonal employees, and we can apply them to our workforce as the year goes by, depending upon how the products are moving out of the distribution center. Obviously, during the October, November, December time frame is when most of the product is moving, but we do find that there are peak times, July 4th, the Memorial Day, where we do have a need for seasonal employees, and this also gives us that capability. The cost of the proposal is just a little over $500,000, and we expect to be able to put back about $40 million in revenue. So there's a very great return for the additional personnel.
Question. When you talk about additional personnel, are you talking about seasonal personnel or full-time personnel?
Mr. Chair, we're talking about within this package is 4 full-time year-round employees and then 4 seasonal employees that we can use at various different times during the year.
I should point out that we presently have limited duration employees in 3 of those 4 spots that we're looking for, which has helped us generate the revenue that we are. If I don't have the staff, we end up paying time and a half until our budget runs out to get the same job done that a regular salaried person could do. So we have 3 limited duration folks up until July 1, but we're asking for us to make 4 permanent positions because we certainly have the need now with the ability to flex during peak use, such as Christmas time.
Has there been a staffing analysis done to determine that it is needed to have 4 full-time employees when the work that's done actually does peak around different holidays and so forth?
Absolutely. We need 4 full-time year-round. In addition, we need to flex at those peak times.
Mm-hmm. Right now you have, out of the 8 positions you're talking about, you have 7 of them. Is that correct? You have 3 limited duration plus already are hiring 4 seasonal?
Mr. Chair, we have 4 limited duration positions, and we do not have any of those. Within the package itself, the 4 seasonals, we do not have any of those positions filled at this point.
Yeah. Okay, so help me understand. You have 4 of the 8 that you're asking for?
Mr. Chair, we have 4 that have been designated as limited duration that will go away at the end of the biennium, so therefore we are putting this package in so that those 4 will become permanent FTE, full-time equivalent employees, and then 4 seasonal employees on top of that that we would spread out during the course of the year.
And if you don't get the 4 additional seasonal employees, how have you been able to make it through the last year if you've got to have them to get through the next year?
Mr. Chair, actually, I guess it's a good way to look at it. We've gotten through the last several years. We have made significant changes in procedures. We have pushed more items to full cases. We have put in a warehouse management system that has certainly helped us in terms of efficiency and effectiveness. We have done a number of different things in order to go ahead and just sort of work our way through the process. but we are at stretching point, breaking point right now. Without those four limited duration employees that we already have, we would have not been able to meet the sales that we met this year.
Okay. I and guess I'm going from four to eight. That's a pretty big step all at once.
Mr. Chairman,
I know they're seasonal.
It's a potential that we could flex. It keeps us from having to go back to the e-board. As our growth continues at this staggering rate, the options are very limited for the growth. Time and a half, cutting back the shipments to the agents, only using the staff that we have. They're less cost-effective options than having the option of temporaries for high-volume times.
Mr. Chair, I might point out that as Executive Director Kaiser already commented, that we do have a choice of using them, you know, at various different times, obviously to meet our peak needs. And there's every indication from the industry that sales not only are going to continue increasing, but get what I would call more complex in a retail sense. We have recently seen products now, believe it or not, that are half calorie. So there are a number of variations on a given theme out there that will come, and the public has been very receptive. That's why we're up to 1,300 different products as it is. So we expect that to continue growing. And when you bring in that many different products, you have to have a lot more individuals handling, because you don't have just with 600, obviously you can handle them a lot faster. But when you've got 1,300 that are seeking to meet our customers' need, there are individual cases that have to be moved by one person at a time. I might also point out that with the four full-time equivalents and then the four seasonals, that really does only work out to six full-time equivalent. As you can see, the merchandising program as part of the OLCC has continued to grow. We do it in concert with our contracted agents. We do it in concert with the liquor industry, and I believe we work very well as a team. We look forward to moving together, but we need your support in terms of technology improvements and personnel in order to keep on moving forward. I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have at this time.
None? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, I would like to ask Linda Ignowski, the regulatory director, to walk you through the regulatory program summary.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Johnson.
While he's packing up his stash of fancy bottles, I guess I'd like to ask the director, what's Plan B? In a highly constrained budget environment, if you do not get those positions from the legislature, how formalized is Option B?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, what we're looking at are a number of options to, they're not necessarily good business options, but they're options to handle the workload with the existing staff. For one thing, we would probably shut down our repack, which means we'll force full cases out the door because we don't have the staff to do the business appropriate activity, which is to ship limited number of high price or low demand items. As you know, we are a bailment, so we pay for it when it goes out the door. It increases our investment in inventory, which if it was a true business environment, we wouldn't go there. But given staff constraints, I could capture maybe an FTE by shutting down repack. We would look at reducing the number of deliveries. We've been increasing deliveries for high-volume stores. Many do not have a lot of storage space. We've been delivering more frequently. We'd have to look at cutting back there. And there are other options for trying to meet demand given the staff we have. But it would have an impact of artificially minimizing the revenue growth that we could otherwise see.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
What's the process by which you include, and I'm going to expand my definition of partners now, to include your frontline workers at OLCC? What's your process to include opinions from them as well as opinions from your partners, the agents, in managing against the possibility that you don't get the positions that you're seeking or the other packages that you're seeking?
We include our Senator Johnson, we include our staff in the planning process in a variety of work groups. Many of them have the expertise necessary to evaluate and help flesh out these choices. We presently have a team that includes staff working on a five-year business plan. We want to identify all the contingencies of growth or of limited growth. At this point, we could artificially reduce our revenue to the $600 million in sales that we're seeing this past year rather than the level in the governor's projected budget.
Continue.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Linda Ignowski. I'm the Regulatory Program Director for the Commission. I'd like to take this opportunity to give you a very brief overview of the program, our goals, and how we're organized and staffed, some of the accomplishments that we have accomplished over the last few years, and a brief summary of our budget packages before you today. The purpose of our program is to effectively regulate the manufacturing, distribution, sale and service, and the consumption of alcohol in the state of Oregon in order to promote the public safety, health, and community livability. Our goal is to maintain compliance with liquor laws by being firm but fair and balancing service and control. We believe that licensees and applicants expect a fair and timely process. We believe the public expects to be able to purchase alcohol from a variety of different sources around the communities. They also expect licensed establishments to stay in compliance with liquor laws and not have a negative impact on the community. So our staff tries to balance these concerns in working with diverse groups such as local governments, local law enforcement, to balance these in order we can provide quality service but also promote responsible alcohol use. Our program is divided into two divisions. The first division is the license process policy division. They're responsible for investigating license application, issuing licenses, renewing liquor licenses, maintaining our files and records, and administering the server education program, and issuing service permits. We have approximately 18 FTE investigators throughout the state of Oregon who do the investigation for our liquor licenses. They processed over 61 license actions last year, and today we have over 11,000 licensees in the state of Oregon. Our server education program was established in 1985 as a mandatory program for anyone who wants to obtain a service permit to sell alcohol by the drink. We had over 24,000 students who went through this class last year alone. In order to serve alcohol by the drink in our establishment, you must have a service permit. We had over 30,000 applications in 1 year. We have approximately 107 service permittees in the state of Oregon right now. And so that's a phenomenal amount of people having service permits. And this continues to grow each year.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. With that volume of applications, if I owned a restaurant and I wanted to expand my bar facilities and wanted to put on 5 new servers, how long would I have to wait to have them go through your processes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, almost zero time. In our process, we allow someone to fill out an application, and as long as it's filled out and signed by the licensee and it's sent to us, they can start working immediately. They have 45 days to complete the requirements of the server education class. So literally, somebody could walk off the street. You could have them sit down, sign, finish the application, which is very simple, and they could go to work.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Where are the server education classes given?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, they are provided by private providers all over the state, so they are all over the state, literally.
Thank you.
So they're all over.
Good. Thanks.
The Field Operations Division is really the Enforcement of Compliance Division. We have 11 offices across the state. That's including headquarters in Portland. We have about 24 district inspectors and 8 special inspectors in a special unit called the Statewide Compliance Team. Their responsibility is to ensure that liquor laws are maintained and on licensed premises, and they do this by education, by training, by contact with our licensees, and also we have some proactive programs. a minor decoy operation, a false ID program, a priority ID program, a DUI report program. We have a multiple of programs that we use to address two of our main issues is minors getting access to alcohol and over-service to patrons.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
We heard a great deal last session when your budget was coming through about sting operations, and frankly, we heard a lot about kind of heavy-handed sting operations. Can you describe to what degree you're still employing that as a regulatory tool?
Chairman Lang, I'm getting used to Chairman Lang. Senator Johnson, as you recall, last time the legislature, there was a new statute that was addressed to how decoy operations were to be conducted across the state. And majority of them in cities that are over 20,000 have to be random. Based on our limited resources and the other things that we need to do for enforcing our liquor laws, we will continue to do minor decoy operations. Many local law enforcement are doing it on their own without our assistance, and so they are still happening, but our forces have been limited in what we can do with that. With the responsibility of having to do them random has reduced what you heard last time is a lot of targeting, and it wasn't probably necessary us, but some other agencies, and so it's probably evened out the playing field a little bit.
Thank you.
Anyway, I would just like to give you a few statistics of what our staff has done. We do a lot, but I just wanted to give you a few. We've issued over 700 criminal citations last year, 850 administrative tickets. We've conducted over 13,000 observations on our licensed premises. We've checked over 6,500 service permits, and we have checked over 11,000 IDs. We have had a couple of successful cases of tracking down the manufacturer of false ID and have shut them down. This is big business for a lot of young people, and so we're trying to get a hold of that. Our staffing, since 1993, the regulatory program has lost over 16 FTE, and the most significant one was last session when we lost 9 positions, specifically in our licensing section. What this has caused is a real impact on the ability for us to issue licenses in a really timely manner. The normal license, if it has no complication, would take about 45 days to issue. What we're finding, especially in the metropolitan area and the Salem area, is this is almost virtually impossible to do. We just have so many license actions happening. It's taking anywhere from 90 to 120 days to process licenses.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
How is that compatible with a customer service performance measure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, that is the issue. We can't provide the customer service that we're trying to do just because of the sheer volume. We just can't get these licenses out in a timely manner. We have done over the years trying to streamline our processes, getting rid of paperwork, eliminating rules that are not necessary anymore. We have streamlined as much as we can to process more quickly. And it's amazing, even through the economical downturn that Oregon experienced, the number of license actions that came through was phenomenal. And I'm not quite sure what the reason for that is, but it is continuing to increase. And I'm not sure, and that is, we are not meeting our customer service needs by not having enough staff to process these.
And so, follow Mr. Chair, so short of coming into the legislature and saying, give us more money, how have you addressed the fact that licensees are waiting 120 days? And that, to me, seems just jaw-droppingly long.
The one way, the director, chairman, Senator Johnson, one way we have addressed that is the director went to the emergency board and got authority to hire three FTEs to help us with our backlog temporarily. And so we have those FTE until the end of this buy-in, which has helped us.
Chair.
Johnson.
How do you quantify how those three FTE have performed? I'm making the assumption prior to the backlog, or prior to the FTEs, the backlog was 120 days. The FTEs came in. What's the backlog now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, our backlog it did decrease. What we do is we have a queue. It's kind of as applications come in, they sit in priority of the time that they came in. And each licensed investigator is responsible for a certain set of number of license cases, which is around 25 to 30 cases at any one given time. At one time when we first got these temporaries, the queue went down to no more than a wait of 1 week before somebody was assigned that application. Unfortunately, we're seeing that increase again.
I'm less interested in when the application was assigned than when the licensee gets a dispositive response from your agency.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we try to process those, especially if ones are a priority that someone is had forgotten to submit their application and they're a huge business that needed to have their, we try to push things forward and address those that have to be a priority, but it's just the sheer volume. So we have tried to address those who absolutely have to have their liquor license, but it's just kind of hard to put somebody ahead of someone else.
Well, I was just going to ask that. How does that give your process any integrity at all? If I'm a small business person and I know that I can get bumped in the queue because of the maladroit handling of somebody bigger, I mean, how's that fair?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, you're right. That is not fair, and we try not to do that. But in some rare cases, we have tried to accommodate. Try to provide that customer service that we try to with not negatively impacting others. Did you want to say something?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, if I might address the problem. We have a growing demand for licenses. We have a finite number of people performing the work. The short-term solution would be to add more people to do the work. A long-term solution is technology, and you will see some of both in our policy option packages. Over the course of the next biennium, I could lay the groundwork for online licensing. It will take one more biennium to get there. That's what customers expect, to be able to get on their computer and finish most of their business. That's how it is with most agencies. That's the current expectation. Over the past few bienniums, we've been passed over when it comes to technology enhancements. It needs to be done. Paperwork has to be done, whether a person does it, our machine does it. I'm more comfortable building a machine to do as much as a machine can do so that we don't have to keep coming back asking for additional staff when the demand for licenses grows. So we have a short-term and a longer-term solution.
Okay. Respectfully, I still don't think I have the answer to my question. I'm trying to see, you had a huge backlog, businesses weren't being served, they couldn't make their contribution to Oregon's economy because they couldn't go into business. You had a 120-day backlog. You added 3 FTE through an emergency board action. After those 3 FTE got on board, how long did the backlog drop? And if I were a business waiting for action from your agency after the 3 FTE were added, how long was my wait then?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I'm having difficulty answering this because the same management reports you're asking me about, I don't have the technology to produce. So we produce hand reports, which I track licenses. We brought the time period below 90 days on average for licenses after we got the 3 additional temporary staff. But demand continues to grow. And what we're seeing, again, as the demand creeps up and up, we're losing the ground that we covered.
Okay. Thank you.
I just wanted to mention a few of our accomplishments is that we have been to the legislature last time you helped fund our document management system. We, for many years or forever, have been on a microfiche system to maintain and keep our files. And so with the help of the legislature, we were able to move into an electronic format in order to keep our records in a more modern format. And hopefully that the storage system is a huge jump forward for us. So that was accomplished in June of 2004. We also developed and implemented a certified certified training program with the cooperation with DPSST, the Police Academy, for all of our inspectors. We conducted that first academy for half of our inspectors in October of last year, and we are conducting the second one starting next month in May. We also provided the service permit application and the license application forms on the website. They're not interactive yet, but at least you can obtain the application online.
How long before they become interactive?
Mr. Chair, that is kind of part of our package, our policy opt-in package, or IT project, is to get them online. And so they're interactive, so somebody could. And I think the first project we're going to try to do is to allow people to renew their licenses online instead of having to do it by paper form.
Well, there's several other agencies that already have interactive licensing mm-hmm. online, and so I assume you're not having to reinvent the wheel. It's merely out kind of taking what is already being done and then fitting it into your needs. So,
Mr. Chairman, we are looking at commercial off-the-shelf software and other solutions that other agencies have and evaluating the most cost-effective method to get there.
Okay. You have no date when you project to be able to do renewals online?
If our policy option package is approved within the coming biennium.
Okay.
And the last thing I would like to mention is that we've been working with the lottery to allow them to connect electronically to share our information and also explore ways to simplify our licensing processes for common applicants, so that's something that is ongoing, and we're very proud of doing that. And as I mentioned before, we have tried very hard to reduce our redundancy of work and try to be more efficient and cut costs because of our limited number of staff. And just to reiterate some of those is that we've changed our rules to reduce unnecessary processes. We've streamlined the internal decision-making process through delegation. We've simplified our application process. We've enhanced our service permit and server education database system to share data and receive data from the industry, and that's specifically from the Oregon Restaurant Education Foundation, so we can receive their test scores electronically. We're reorganizing our infrastructure and field operations to better meet our goals and objectives of the commission. And our division is actively working in partnership with policy and business partners in order to resolve issues and concerns among the groups. We have some legislative concepts out there for this 2005 legislative session that will allow businesses to start serving alcohol sooner, simplify special events fee structure, and allow more flexibility at these events, charge an application fee to fund additional license investigators, and increase time for service permit applications to request a hearing.
Okay.
Oregon has
Just
been.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a little confused because I thought I heard you say that we're still dealing with manual forms, but yet your accomplishments list conversion of license forms to electronic formats. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, basically we moved from we having to send you an application in the mail, so you've been able to pull one down off the internet and be able to print it off yourself. What we haven't been able to do yet is for you to be able to go on the internet, fill out the application, and send it to us electronically. You would still have to print it out and fill it out and send it to us manually by mail or bringing it to us. And so when I say we've converted our forms to electronic, we've got it on a computer instead of a piece of paper.
Thank you.
Okay. since you're a new community, I just thought I'd mention just a few of the things about Oregon has been a leader in a lot of the things in the liquor industry.
May I interrupt just for a moment?
Sure.
I'm wondering, I've got some specific questions, and I appreciate the overview. Because of the time, I'd like to just,
sure.
I don't know if I should address them to you or to someone else, and they have to do with expenditures and revenue categories and those kinds of things. Who would I ask that of?
Michael. I'll get him the chair.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Mr. Chairman, what page are you on?
I'm on the very last tab, the budget support, detail revenues and expenditures, and I'm on page 1 of 10.
Budget document.
In the budget
document.
I'll wait for you to get on the same page I'm on.
I'm sorry, are you in our presentation document?
One more time.
Budget
yeah,
document.
Okay.
Governor's
budget. Okay. On the very last tab, says special reports. And then it's about a half an inch down. And it's in the upper right-hand corner, says agency number 8450. And lower right-hand corner, or it's page 1 of 10. It says budget support, detailed revenues and expenditures.
84500 or 8450?
84500. Got it? 1 of 10? You guys got it?
Which page?
Page 1 of 10.
So it looks like
it orbits
under which tab? I'm sorry.
The very last tab.
Under selected reports.
It's the orbits documents agency summary, page 1.
Got it?
I think it's the same page.
Okay. I'm looking at the second category. It says revenue categories, and then it says underneath that taxes, and it says 0185 privilege taxes. Do you see that? Are we on the same sheet? Would you like to come take a look at what sheet, ma'am?
Please.
I think she has it.
I think so.
Okay.
This one you have, such?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You've explained, as a group, you've explained that privilege taxes come primarily from the importation, you know, fees on different liquors and so forth, and it's a $26.7 million source.
And actually, that's on wine and beer only.
Is that what this is, wine and beer only? Okay, as we look at it, under privileged taxes, it shows that we have a reduction from the 03-05 estimate, so I assume that that means estimated for the full 2 years. And then you look at the governor's recommended budget, it goes from $22 million to $19 million. And then that's from all funds. Beneath that it says general fund revenue, and it goes from $33,589,000 to $7.3 million. And I'm just wondering if you could explain what's going on there.
I'm sorry, if I'm looking at the privilege tax line, 0185.
Correct.
And it shows the 2,305 estimates of 25.7.
Okay, you're looking at the grand total, and I'm looking at the two lines above that, the increments.
I'm sorry, we must still be looking at a different page.
All right. Well, there's also, while she's coming up, a question on sales income. Do you see that at the very bottom of that page?
For the $623 million?
We don't have the same date stamp.
Right,
it's just a number.
It's sounding pretty much like a litigation.
0148.
Doesn't sound like you're going to testify.
That is what we have in our budget document.
It's going to be first hand. You got it?
Would you like to borrow that?
That's a great idea.
Is my company.
Let's talk about it.
Mr. Chair, you have the 26.6 is the total amount estimated for next biennium of the privileged taxes. The 7.3, I believe, is the portion of that $26.7 million that would be distributed as net income to the general fund.
Okay.
If I can go back to our original flow chart, the schematic, we source all the sources of revenue from all the various types of revenue. Out of the general, out of the privilege tax, half of that goes to the mental health, drug, and alcohol treatment. The other half goes into the pool of all the available resources. We then pay from that all of our bills, and whatever's left is then distributed. A portion of that privilege tax as a result that flows into the pool is then distributed to the general fund.
Okay, I'm comparing the 0507 governor's recommended budget of $7,000,003 with the 0305 estimates, which is $3,500,000. And so I'm wondering, why is there a $3,300,000 increase in that column?
And Mr. Chair, off the top of my head, I don't know. I'll have to look for you and find out.
Okay, one line up, it says other funds limited under privileged taxes. And we're going from $22,157,000 down to $19 million. And so I'm wondering where the $2 million...
You bet. I'll have to find out exactly what went into those numbers.
Okay.
The bottom line number, the all funds, is the estimate for the privilege tax revenue.
There is. But I'm just trying to, do a little spot check. Okay?
You bet.
If you looked at the bottom of that page, it says fines and forfeitures. And for the current biennium, it's $500,000. And for the next biennium, it's $760,000. Which is, like a 40% increase. Can you tell me why there would be that increase?
I'll have to find out on that for the specifics as well.
Next line says sales income, other funds limited. It shows the 0103 actuals of $469,657, the 0305 estimates of $28,000, and the 0507 governor's recommended budget estimate of $468,000. And so I'm asking, why would there be such a huge variance in there?
And actually, a lot of that would be for bulk alcohol sales, warehouse sales, some of the revenue from sales to reservations. Those go into a miscellaneous sales. As a percentage of our total sales, it's a very small percentage.
Okay, what I'm doing is testing your accounting.
You bet.
Because two biennials ago, it was $469,000. This biennium, it's $28,000, and next biennium, it's $468,000. So I'm trying to figure out
previous,
why it's swing.
Yeah, you bet. The previous legislatively adopted budget, there may have been a change in the estimate of what the bulk alcohol sales were going to be or how much we were going to be making in miscellaneous sales. And I don't have that off the top of my head.
Absolutely, shooting in the dark, because for you to have a swing from $468,000 to $28,000, now that's a change in sales.
And
since the sales have only increased, that's probably not the correct answer. I don't mind coming back. But
you bet. But actually, this particular line is not liquor sales. It's, okay. It's other sales. It'd be sales to the Indian reservation, sales to the military, the Air Force bases, Coast Guard bases.
So we may have knocked off sales for 2 years.
Right. They may have been reduced. There may not have been a much, or bulk alcohol, which can be a substantial reduction. I don't know off the top of my head.
Substantial reduction.
Yeah. I can find out.
I think
out
that's
for you.
Probably not related, since it's unlikely that there's been an 80 or 85% reduction in sales for 2 years and then going back up again. So I'm just trying to see
you
where your numbers come from.
I'll find out.
Okay? If you could continue on down. Oh, that's not, no, that's a. There's another line where it actually is dealing with that same question, so I can. I'll reserve that. Other questions on that we're going to deal with? We're going to run out of time here in a few minutes, so I just wanted to see if there's other questions. I was looking at the very end of this, the pitch report on management to staff, and. I'd like to have somebody explain that to me. It looks like, I just wanted to see how that works out, and I won't take our time to do that.
Did you have a specific question on it?
We
can have somebody address that.
By departments, my question is going to be, what is the ratio of management to staff members? Since every management position has inherent costs, I just want to make sure that for the people of Oregon that they are in line with what's actually needed.
Okay. And we'll get somebody to answer the question for us.
Thank you. Let's see. Director Kaiser, we have 20 minutes left. What do you think we should accomplish in the next 20 minutes?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about our technology policy option package. I have a six-minute-long video that I think really summarizes our need. But first, if I could set it up in a paragraph or two, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
I would like you to know that on March 10th, we appeared before the House Information Management and Technology Committee and discussed the package in depth. We were pleased that by the end of the almost two-hour presentation and question period, the committee indicated it would be recommending that Ways and Means approve the package. We believe our proposed technology solutions will help us provide better services to business and consumers who keep the alcohol, beverage, and hospitality industries vital components of Oregon's economic life. With the increase in our workload, it makes sense to find an IT solution as opposed to adding more staff solution. And I'd like to show you this film. Seeing is believing. You have to see the conditions we work under.
Yeah, we can hardly wait. We need to see that film.
If I were to tell you about the state of technology at OLCC today, I would tell you about a very stark contrast. In our warehouse, we have technology that is wonderful. We have handheld devices to track our products. We have a business management system that really assists us to move the thousands and thousands of cases of product that we have. We couldn't be as effective without it.
This year, compared to last year, we shipped out a little over 2 million cases. This year, we're looking at shipping about 2.2 million cases with the same number of people, and a lot has to do with the efficiency and the effectiveness of the new technology.
And the rest of the agency, we do not have technology. We have typewriters. We have primitive systems.
I made a mistake and removed it from the typewriter, then I'll have to move right out to cover over this mistake.
In any ordinary business today, we would not have people using typewriters. We would have them on computers. And yet, although we're drowning in work, in revenue-generating work, I have to deploy limited staff that I have to perform tasks that are better done by a computer.
When we receive a liquor license application, the file control clerk makes a cardboard card for each member of the LLC, corporation, or each individual. And that can be one card to probably 15 or 20 cards. They're typed on with a typewriter, then they're hand-filed. The retriever holds all the cards. Anytime there's any changes to an application, those cards need to be retrieved, one for the LLC, one for each member or each individual, and again, they're typed on individual lines at a time, then they're refiled. When the retriever was first purchased, it was a big jump in technologies. Compared to the technology that is available today, however, it's ancient.
Inspectors, when they're out in the field, they're going to premises, and so they call me and let me know where they're going. So I, if they need backup, I can call for police and know where to send them.
Adam 7. Can you check the minor posting that's on file for this location?
Stand by. Inspectors may call in wanting to know what kind of minor posting is in various spots in the premises, and they might go in and see that minors in a place that they don't think they should be, so they're asking to pull their liquor license and actually look at the floor plan and see what's posted. probably the biggest advantage to having updated technology would be that I could get the inspectors the information they needed much quicker, and it would also not take me away from my desk where I sometimes miss very important phone calls or emergency phone calls from other inspectors who are also out in the field needing something at the same time. With the document management system that we installed last year, we were able to take our technology and go from microfilming pieces of paper to actually turning them into electronic images that are currently available online to OLCC staff. With the technology package we're asking for, we can dovetail in with that system and utilize it to its full capacity. There's something called workflow component that we actually already own but do not have the infrastructure to use. So with workflow, things would be smooth, fast, and efficient.
This budget package will move OLCC forward in the following ways. On the merchandising side, we will have streamlined efficiency in terms of getting the product out. We won't have products stored that we don't need, and we'll have holes on the shelves when we need a product that the customer wants. Having the right product in the right place at the right time means sales. Sales are increasing, they'll increase even more, and you'll see that in terms of revenue. On the licensing side, you're going to see licenses happen quicker. What does that mean for Oregon? It means places open faster, people have jobs faster. On the regulatory side, you'll see efficiency in being able to use the time interacting with our licensees, not back at the office or on the phone trying to get information. Why should you support this budget package? Supporting this budget package will yield substantial returns in terms of revenue, beginning next biennium and every biennium thereafter. It will return substantial savings in terms of efficiency this biennium and every biennium thereafter.
Adam Sutton, I have your information if you're ready to copy.
In the best case scenario, when somebody calls in for information from the field, whether it's from the dispatcher or from the file control clerk,
they have a minor three posting.
It's a minimum of 10 minutes before the information is retrieved, and it can be as long as the next day. The whole process is very manual, very time-consuming, inefficient.
How OLCC functions determines how well other businesses function.
That film?
The film, as you could probably tell from my sweater, Mr. Chairman, was made in December around the holidays. We thought, since I can't bring each and every one of you down there to see just how it is, that maybe I could show you.
Very effective. It is antiquated.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
I just am curious. You say that on the film that the investment in these packages will bring significant revenue this biennium and every biennium, biennium after. Have you, and maybe it's in the presentation materials, I just didn't see it or didn't know where to go get it. Have you done a pro forma that projects that revenue? And the reason that I ask is that we have heard from other agencies, give us X FTE or give us X policy package and we will return your investment a jillionfold. And then you come the next session and it's, whoops, we missed that estimate by a little bit. And I'm just curious, what do you back up your assertion that significant revenues will be returned to the state this biennium and every number of biennia after?
I think if you look, Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, if you look at the governor's proposed budget, it's presupposing approval of this. We're presently generating around $600 million of biennium in sales. We're projecting around $645 million with our policy option packages. That translates into another $5.7 million in additional general fund know, I'm accountable for that. I'm responsible for that. We've exceeded our projections in the every time in the past. We will meet this projection with the approval of our budget. Without it, you can expect about what we did this last biennium. It's a huge opportunity to move forward, plus position ourselves to deliver that kind of customer service you know the citizens want, electronic, interactive access.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
How would you feel about having any of these packages tied to that level of performance with that level of specificity? I'm talking about increased revenues. I'm talking about less time in the queue, some fixed amount of time. If you're getting more people, more technology, the expectation that your customers will be served better in addition to the revenues. I don't want it just all tied on the revenues. I think it's unfair to have people wait 120 days for action by a state agency. That just is, in my view, unacceptable.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I agree. However, I should point out that the same staff that are processing the licenses will have to help me create the information technology as the users. So I need them in almost a dual role to build this. So during this coming biennium, to anticipate that I could additionally streamline even while we're building it is not realistic. I hope to maintain pace. What you will see in our legislation is a request to allow temporary licenses as kind of a bridge until I can get the technology built for low-risk, about 90% of our licensees that are in a low-risk location, low-risk applicant, to allow a 90-day temporary on a new license to give us the time to process them.
Senator Johnson.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair. When you use the terminology, build it, and you're using that, I think, if I understood you correctly, in the context of information technology, am I right in that assumption?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I don't mean to imply that we're going to customize a solution. In fact, we are going to seriously look at a commercial off-the-shelf solution as a preferred alternative, provided it can meet the needs.
You've answered part of my question. You say you are going to look at. That activity hasn't happened in anticipation of the session?
Chairman Richardson, Senator Johnson, we've been working on this for over a year. We're at the point of releasing RFIs. Our deadline was to get everything in place to release an RFP at the release. By the time the money's ready, we're ready to hit the road. We've been working on it for over a year. We have a project manager from DAS IRMD. I'm pushing as fast as I can with our limited resources. We are at the release of the RFI stage to gather from the rest of the world, what are the options out there? What are the potential solutions now that we have identified our user needs? That's a huge chunk of work, identifying your needs.
Thank you.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This looks like a pretty classic case of process improvement. Have you performed any kind of cost-benefit analysis or, as we would in the private sector, a return on investment analysis so that you can formally get at the issues that Senator Johnson is addressing? If we invest X, we expect a Y return and then have something to go back and measure against in the future.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, we are looking at the return on the investment. It's, as you know, not science. A lot of it is art. We're attempting to get our arms around it. What you see reflected in the governor's budget is the increase from all of these pieces. The work continues to grow. It makes sense to do it with technology. If you look at the whole policy option package on IT, it's less than one half of 1% of the revenue that we generate. If you compare that to an industry standard, we're far below the investment in IT. For a $645 million biennium business, we're very primitive in our infrastructure.
Okay. Further questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, are we coming back tomorrow?
Yeah.
So we'll have an opportunity to ask
We will, although it's also scheduled that we have a work session, and the co-chairs have reviewed this, and so that if there's some burning consideration, we'd ought to talk with them this afternoon.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I would refer to page 5 of 10 in the same data that you were referencing earlier. The other payroll expenses amount to about $14,720 per FTE increase. And I wonder if we could address that. We're running out of time here, but maybe tomorrow we could look at that particular page.
Okay, I'm on 5 of 10. Which line, number 30?
At the bottom, page 5 of 10,
okay.
Other payroll expenses.
Right.
We have a total there of what would equate to about, you know, nearly $15,000 per FTE. Flexible benefits, particularly, equates to about $5,600 per FTE.
That's a huge increase.
Pretty dramatic increases.
Okay. Would you like to discuss why there's a 40% increase? I mean, is it per? I know they're going to say PERS and health benefits, but why don't you just tell us what you think?
And Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services. I can talk about the flexible benefits, and this is what you see in almost all agency budgets. The flexible benefits for 2003-2005 was, I think, $665 per employee, and for 2005-2007, it's increasing to $771 around that range. So if you look at even other agency budgets, that's one line item where you would be seeing a significant increase.
Mr. Chairman, of this magnitude?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, in this one, we would have to look at the details and we'll get back to you tomorrow. But the flexible benefits, it's increasing from $665 per employee to $771. And that's mainly because of health benefits cost. But in this specific case, we will look at it and come back to you tomorrow.
Appreciate maybe picking this up tomorrow.
Were you looking at 214 employees?
211 employees.
This would be 214.
Plus three. Well, still, that's not going to change.
Okay, it's three more people.
Yeah, I didn't change it that much.
No, I understand. So tomorrow morning, would you come in with greater detail as to with that size, with 214 employees? You have an increase from 6.658 million to 9.408 million just in the one area of other payroll expenses.
Certainly.
Have a breakdown on that. Along with a breakdown on managers and so forth. Okay. And with that, why don't we make this a logical break in our discussion, and we'll reconvene in the morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me. Tomorrow afternoon. Thank you very much. Not objection, we're adjourned.